How's it going, everybody? It is 2:40 in the afternoon on Saturday, which is way out of the ordinary, but nevertheless, it's time for a trip down the homeward path. This is a show by me, Adam, an MTG dad for all of you at home, who are playing Magic on a budget, time, financial, whatever the case may be. Magic is your escape from the rigors of everyday life, and this is, I'm trying to be your voice. So, while we were away this week, I had a lot more non-magic related stuff going on than I had magic related stuff. So, my son ended up hospitalized for a day and a half after being exposed to the coronavirus, and for the life of me, I can't figure out where, other than Sarah seems to think he got it when he licked a table at Vanderbilt earlier in the week when they went up for a doctor's appointment. And then, you know, we got out of the hospital Thursday, we had a full night to recover, and then turned around Friday morning, and we had to go to Vanderbilt for another appointment for Esther to go see her nutritionist to talk about working on her tube feeds, and it's just a mess all the way around. But there was a bright spot in that I got to offload quite a bit of bulk while I was there. There's a used bookstore in Nashville, if any of you are in the area and have not given it a shot. If you need to unload bulk cards, you need to take them to McKay's. Magic or Yu-Gi-Oh, they have a big section for both. And, like, I brought in, Nick had given me a bunch of stuff, and then I contributed to it, and we ended up with somewhere around 4,500 cards, and I got, like, $33 in store credit for it. So, that was pretty sweet. And then they have all the cards that they bring in up in, a custom-constructed wooden box upstairs, and you can rifle through them and fill up a bag for $2. It's really sweet. And it's one of the easiest ways to find random old cards that maybe you couldn't find. It's basically how I build Pauper decks at this point, is I just make a McKay's run and see if I can find them. That was my day yesterday. But more importantly, we had War of the Spark spoilers all week long. And as excited as I am about the cards, I'm really excited about, like, the way this set's being designed from, like, a flavor perspective. Because, again, it's like I mentioned in my last episode, or maybe the episode before, I can't remember for sure. It's like nothing we've ever done before, right? So, this week I thought I would take an opportunity to look at not just the spoilers themselves, but the flavor of these spoilers, the way they tie into, not just from a mechanical sense, into the set for limited or for constructed, but just, like, how some of these cards tie up loose ends in the story. And speaking of tying up loose ends, you should tie up the loose ends you have in content consumption by checking out the network over at constructedcriticism.com, because they will tie up all your loose ends when it comes to Magic content. They have a show for everybody, it seems like, and then some. So do yourself a favor and check that out. You can also tie up your loose ends for your accessory needs by checking out our sponsor over at inkedgaming.com. Use the promo code CCMTG10 at checkout, get 10% off your order, and make your playing surface look sweet. Or your cards, like, whatever you want to do. If you want to support the show directly, you can do so at patreon.com/homewardpathmtg. The show will always be free, but it's thanks to donations from patrons that I have been able to upgrade. This is the first episode I am recording on my new headset. It just came in today, this morning. So I hope it's to everyone's liking. It seems to be picking up really well on the app. And without any further ado, let's dive right in, shall we? So War of the Spark spoilers have started rolling in, and the way they're doing them is flavorful. Like, again, it's like nothing we've ever done before. It's a set that's based around the story event and everything. You know, yes, the cards are designed for gameplay. The cards are designed for limited, designed for constructed, whatever. But they're also designed to tell the story, which is, they've never done that as a focal point of a set design before. So, you know, we should all take a minute to just appreciate the genius behind doing it this way. It's made spoiler season a whole lot more fun. It's made revealing the cards a lot more fun, because even the random draft commons have a fun reason to be revealed. But even within the set, there's more stuff to do. Like, we have the cycle of Bonds. We have the cycle of bonds, which is two guilds merging over their common colors. And what it seems to be doing is creating the shards on Ravnica, but, you know, whatever. You know, there's going to be complaints about that. I don't care. What is cool is the way that they are melding the identities of two guilds together around the color that they have in common with these cards. Like, the blue bond, whose name escapes me, I believe it's Bond of Intelligence or Bond of Intellect. I can't remember. But it's a spell that mills cards and then returns two instants and sorceries to your hand. That's so good. And it's such a perfect flavor smack in the... It just hits the flavor right in the commonalities between Dimir and Izzet. You know, it's just so good. You have the charm or the bond of passion, which was revealed either this morning or yesterday by Jim Davis on stream. And it's 6 mana. You get to threaten and burn something. It's a threaten and a 2 damage to any target for 6 mana. Now, that's obviously a limited card. But from a design standpoint, that is the most red thing you can possibly do for 6 mana. But it also plays into both the Gruul and the Boros mentality, right? Both of them like to disrupt things that don't agree with them. Both of them like to smack down stuff that doesn't agree with them. You know, the Bond of Flourishing, I think, is the name of it. The green one, which is between Selesnya and Simic, is Adventurous Impulse meets... Oh, gosh. I would forget. Hang on. Let me find it. I had an image, I believe. I guess not. Never mind. Thought I had the image saved. I guess I don't. Anyway. It's another example, though, of really good design from... it's like a slightly more powerful Adventurous Impulse for 2 mana. Really good. That's what it is. Look at the top 3, take a permanent from among them, and put it into your hand. That's what it is. That's so perfect. You have the Orzhov and the Azorius bonding over their shared white mana. Which is, tap all your opponent's creatures and one of yours gains lifelink for the turn. I'm going to lose a lot of games in Limited to that card. I already know it. I'm going to lose a lot of games in Limited to that card. It's going to be awesome. But then we have the other cycle that's working its way around, which are the Eternal Gods. So, for the people who remember or read the story through Amonkhet Hour of Devastation, at the end of it, Bolas actually killed... Bolas didn't directly kill them. His gods that he stole from Amonkhet when he first arrived. Because for those who remember, there were 8 gods originally on Amonkhet. And when Bolas swooped down on the plane and took control, Bolas managed to take 3 of them for his own purposes, which were the Scarab God, Locust God, and Scorpion God, respectively. Which left the 5 single, you know, the 5 monocolored guilds of Amonkhet, which were Ronus, Hazoret, Kefnet, Bontu, and Oketra. All but Hazoret, of whom died during the climax of our devastation when Bolas finally descended and, you know, cut loose the 3 gods that he had kept under wraps for all this time, right? So, Kefnet. Kefnet, Oketra, Ronus, and Bontu all died. Or so we thought. Turns out, Bolas just took them, resurrected them, and made them into kind of the field generals, if you will, of his Eternal Army. Which is also a fantastic flavor callback from Amonkhet Hour of Devastation. You know, the eternalized mechanic making these creatures more powerful. Well, now we're thinking less in the each individual creature standpoint and more in the make... a giant army of undead standpoint, so we have a mass instead of eternalize as the actual mechanic, which I can't say I disagree with. There's a lot of good graveyard mechanics in Standard right now. We don't need to throw another one in there. But it seems like every time they do gods, they do something a little bit different and something a little bit better. So in the case of the original gods, you know, the Theros block gods, they were not creatures unless your devotion was high enough. And then they would come to fight, you know, come to your aid for real. But they provided a benefit that you could build around, which made them obvious commander staples. And obviously some of them were also good and constructed, like regular constructed. But then we had the gods of... Words failing. We had the gods of Amonkhet, the first set in the Amonkhet block, which were indestructible. And then as long as you were fulfilling the condition of what they were about, they were able to attack and block for you. So instead of actively seeking you to parasite your deck into blue or red or green or white or red, they asked you to do something that those colors care about, which is a better design to me. You know, it's a more interesting design because it shows you the character of each god. You know, Bantu wanted you to sacrifice and then would give you the outlet to do so. Hazoret wanted you to have no cards, wanted you to just be putting it all out there, and then gave you a way to help do that. Oketra wanted you to attack with a bunch of stuff, or wanted you to have a bunch of other creatures, and then gave you a way to help do that. Kefnet wanted you to hold as much wisdom as you could, wanted you to have all the cards you could have, and then helped you with that. Ronus wanted you to have big, stupid stuff in play, wanted you to have big, powerful things, and then helped you do it, right? But they were still falling under the idea of being indestructible creatures who wanted you to do a certain thing. Now, it wasn't necessarily devotion, but it did give you a payoff for doing the thing that they wanted you to do, right? Hazoret was one of the best cards in Standard. Easily. Like, not even close. Well, the God Eternal cycle is four of those five gods. For those who don't remember, Hazoret actually survived Hour of Devastation, did not get killed, and in fact led the survivors into the desert to find a safe place to live now that the city was destroyed. So now we have the other four that have been raised by Bolas and made to serve the army in the form of the God Eternals. Now we don't have all of them yet. We have Bantu, Ronus, and Kefnet revealed so far. So to start with, let me find it. Where'd I have it? I had it. I know I did. Well... I know I had it. Anyway, Bantu is big and nasty and allows you to sacrifice a bunch of permanents on the way in, and then you draw a card for each. So instead of providing you with a bonus to the, you know, the devotion of the sacrificial mechanic and then giving you a small outlet to do it, it's up to you to figure out your bonus. It's going to give you the most powerful outlet you can ask for. That's a big difference in design. Kefnet, instead of wanting you to have a bunch of cards, Kefnet is going to give you access to a bunch more spells if you can buy into taking advantage of it. Again, I don't have an image of Bantu in front of me. I'm keeping the phone on airplane mode so I am not interrupted. But... Kefnet is a 4-mana 4/5 flying. You may reveal the first card you draw each turn as you draw it. Whenever you reveal an instant or sorcery this way, copy that card and you may cast the copy. The copy costs 2 less to cast. So it gives your spells miracle. And particularly noteworthy because we have cards like Opt and Chemist's Insight and Standard. Let's think about that for a minute. That's a thing that we can do. And then all of them so far, you know, Ronus doubles the power of all of your creatures and gives them vigilance. Oh my goodness, that is powerful. They are just like more outwardly powerful if you can find the way to break them. They put the onus on you to do it instead of helping you along the way, which I love as a design philosophy. And then, again, we have the differences in the designs, because we had the original cycle of gods and the newer cycle from Amonkhet were all indestructible. Well, then we had the three gods that Bolas had corrupted that, instead of being indestructible, would just get back up again after you killed them. i.e. Scarab God, Scorpion God, Locust God, all three of them, when they die, you put them back in your hand at the end of the turn. So you can just bring them right back to the battle. Well, the God Eternals all share that ability. When they die or are put into exile from the battlefield, which is important because that makes them far superior to any of the other ones in this regard, as long as they get there from the battlefield, you can put it into your library third from the top. That's amazing. Now, it does create a nice delay so that your opponent can strategize, can create an opportunity so that they can take it away from you permanently with something like counter magic or hand disruption, or maybe even just milling it off the top of your library with something like a Jace. But whatever the case may be, it's an interesting recursion clause, not just because it goes into the library, but because even if it gets exiled, it goes into the library, which laughs in the face of a card like Ixalan's Binding that would otherwise be an absolute deterrent to this kind of an effect. You know, if it was just when it's put into a graveyard, that'd be real unfortunate. So I'm glad they took the opportunity to balance it. We also have the cycle of triumphs, which call back to a cycle from Hour of Devastation, which were the defeats. It was the way that each one of the Gatewatch was defeated by Bolas, except each one of them experiences a triumph during War of the Spark. That's awesome. I love that they called back to that so well. I love that the story arcs are all kind of coming together. We have the story arc involving Niv-Mizzet, who apparently dies and then gets reborn as a five-color monstrosity. Now, this card is going to be a commander I will eventually build. It's not something I'm going to be, like, super in on. But it's going to be something I'm going to eventually build because it's a style of play that I've wanted to do for a long time. That being the Lucky Charms play style, where you're just playing kind of a lot of stuff and you're not really sure how you're going to win. You just make sure you can keep playing a lot of stuff. But Niv-Mizzet Reborn is one of every color for a 6/6 flying legendary creature dragon avatar. And when he enters the battlefield, reveal the top 10 cards of your library. For each color pair, choose a card that's exactly those colors from among them, put them into your hand, and the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. What's important about this is that it specifically says each color pair and exactly those colors, which means you can't get away with playing three or four color cards and being able to snag them off a Niv. Can't do it. You gotta have a card that's exactly each pair of colors in order to snag it off of Niv-Mizzet, which is a really interesting deck-building constraint, both for Standard and Commander. Interesting to note was the idea of playing stuff like Discovery and Dispersal in your otherwise, let's say, Teemer or Bant deck, because it's a blue-black card that you can snag off a Niv-Mizzet if you can make it. Obviously, we have Chromatic Lantern in the format to make Niv-Mizzet's casting cost easier to manage. And then we also have Firemind's Vessel, which is 4 mana, tap to add 2 of any color. That's really good. So, like, from a deck-building constraint standpoint, it opens up the possibility of finally, as a... There's kind of a trend in some of the commander decks that I've wanted to build for a while, in that I wanted to showcase the flavor of a plane in a deck or the flavor of a concept in a deck. So like for Niv-Mizzet Parin, I wanted it to be as like is it as possible. Just draw a ton of cards, do a bunch of weird stuff, and then figure out a way to win the game eventually. Chain a bunch of stuff together. Maybe it gets there. Maybe it kills me. I don't know. Let's have fun. Let's find out together. Niv-Mizzet Reborn, on the other hand, is very much a let's exemplify what it means when the guilds are united as a deck. Like, that's what Niv-Mizzet Reborn is about. In this deck, you want all 10 charms, you want all 10 guild leaders, like, you want everything you can do to really kind of personify a united Ravnica as a commander deck. And that's really appealing, and I really hope my buddy Brian gets around to building it, and I'm hoping we're kind of on a similar wavelength from a construction standpoint. I really do. Because it just seems like it's going to be so much fun to play. To say nothing of playing cards like Chamber Sentry or, you know, Ramos or whatever. Seems like a ton of fun. You know, it just seems like it's going to be so much fun. to say nothing of, you know, just Niv-Mizzet's, you know, in limited, having that aggressively five color mana base, it's going to be a lot harder to cast in limited. It may just be completely unplayable in limited. We'll find out. I've been 100% wrong about five color being viable in limited before, so I'm not going to write it off completely. And it is a 6/6 flying for five. So, you know, it basically is better than anything else anybody can do. But I love that we're getting there with these designs. They're so, so flavorful from the kinds of, you know, the story they're trying to tell here. All these planeswalkers coming, these planeswalkers not being able to leave, the blood feud between Nahiri and Sorin, everything that's going on here in this plane, it really speaks to the nostalgia, even just of the last 3 or 4 years. You know, even since 2016, when I started playing again, all these stories call back to the things I've been reading. So I'm just really, really jazzed about the flavor of them. Now, God's honest truth, my favorite card that I've seen revealed in the set so far is the new Saheeli. And I'm not ashamed to admit that, because that card is bananas. Absolutely bananas. B-A-N-A-N-E-S. Some of you might be too young to get that joke, and I probably am too old to get that joke, but that's beside the point. She is one, is Saheeli Sublime Artificer for one, and then hybrid blue-red. 5 loyalty. Whenever you cast a non-creature spell, create a 1/1 colorless servo artifact creature token. Full stop. I'm already in on this card. So we're already playing cards like Murmuring Mystic in Is It Drake and Is It Phoenix and Temur Reclamation. Isn't this just a better Murmuring Mystic? It's 3 mana instead of 4. It triggers on any non-creature spell, not just an instant or sorcery. So a Planeswalker, a Wilderness Reclamation, an Artifact. All of these things trigger Saheeli. Notable because we have Mox Amber in the format that's been looking for a home for a while. Oh, by the way, she also has more text on her. -2, target artifact you control becomes a copy of another target artifact or creature you control until end of turn, except it's an artifact in addition to its other types. So, the creature she makes are servo artifact tokens, obviously. So you can just turn one of those into a Crackling Drake, or turn one of those into an Arclight Phoenix, or turn one of those into a Terramander and adapt it. And then it'll keep the counters, even though it loses the flying. Think about that. Think about that. That sounds like so much fun. Sounds a little bit obnoxious, right? It sounds like exactly what these kinds of decks needed to retain their staying power in a format that seems like it wants to slow down a little bit more. Is just give them that little bit of extra punch and the ability to grind a little bit harder if they can't get there. That's exactly what these kinds of deck needs. And that's exactly the kind of deck I love playing. So I'm going to play the crap out of this card. I'm going to play this card way more than I probably should. Bear that in mind. Probably going to happen. So, I mean, I also can't believe this card's an uncommon, by the way. That's amazing. Is it better than Young Pyromancer in Modern and Legacy? Probably not. In Modern, solely because of the Stubborn Denial problem, but I love it. I like the fact that you can play it in decks that you couldn't play Young Peasy in because you don't want to stretch your mana into the extra color. You can play Saheeli in decks that only make blue mana or only make red mana. It can be a redundant copy of Young Pyromancer in Mardu Pyromancer that also just turns into a Bedlam Reveler, you know, turns one of the tokens into a Bedlam Reveler later and cast 2 or 3 spells and kill your opponent. Like, that seems fine. Or you get really cheeky and turn one of the tokens into a Young Pyromancer and just flood the crap out of the board. I'm going to do it. I'm not going to say it's going to be good, but I'm going to do it. Maybe it's just straight blue-red Pyromancer. Maybe that's good enough now that you have redundant copies of Pyromancer without having to stretch into white mana to have access to Monastery Mentor. Like, it's going to be a thing I'm going to do. And I'm going to have a lot of fun with it. And I'm probably going to lose a lot of games of Magic along the way. But I'm going to do it. There's some Commander staples that have already been viewed. Evolution Sage. Landfall Proliferate. Full stop. That's gross. We have all the experience counter commanders. We have all the plus one counter commanders. We have all the charge counter commanders. We have the existence of Voril of the Hulkblade, Jared. We have, you know, there's infect commanders in green, Saskia, among others. That card's great. To say nothing of loading extra charge counters on cards like Pented Prism or Sphere of the Sun, so just make sure your mana's nice and smooth. The card's really good. Kasmina Enigmatic Mentor is an interesting one. Another one of the uncommon planeswalkers. She's 4 mana, 5 loyalty. Spells your opponents cast that target a creature or planeswalker you control cost 2 more. So playing a 4-drop on turn 4 that makes their Vraska's Contempts cost 6 seems fine. That gives you a chance to close the door. We have Solar Blaze, which is Justice Strike to everyone. You might even call it the United States of Smash, if it had blue in its mana cost. Anyway, I hope somebody appreciates that joke. I really do. And my favorite card so far that I've seen previewed, not from a playability standpoint, just from the oozing callback to old Ravnica thing, is Feather the Redeemed and the Parhelion 2. So, for those of you who don't remember the original story, Feather was the closest friend Agriskos had in the original Ravnica novel. She was his beat partner for a lot of the series until he retired. And her wings were bound because of something that she had done. Well, in the end, she was eventually released. She's one of the few remaining Firemane angels left after Aurelia took over, the four-winged variety. And the flavor on the card is so interesting. It's just the most unique Boros commander I've ever seen. Whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell that targets a creature you control, exile it instead of putting it into your graveyard as it resolves. If you do, return it to your hand at the beginning of the next instep. That's a pretty interesting line of text. Because it makes your pump spells, it makes the original Boros mechanic in Radiance playable in Commander. Cards like Bathing Light that target one of your creatures but hit all of them. You can loop that. You can protect your whole team multiple times over the course of a game. Parhelion 2, 8 mana vehicle. Flying First Strike Vigilance 5/5, and whenever it attacks, create 2 4/4 white angel tokens with Flying Vigilance that are attacking. That's a real good way to just kill somebody. So it's a 5/5, it makes 2 more 4/4s that are also attacking. That's a lot of damage out of nowhere. To say nothing, and it's crew 4 to turn it into a creature. I'm gonna win and lose some games with that in Limited. I can already tell. We have 4 mana Chandra. Is she as good as the last 4 mana Chandra? Oh my heavens, no. No, she is not. But she's got really important text on her too. Whenever one or more loyalty counters are removed from Chandra, she deals that much damage to target opponent or planeswalker, which means even when she takes damage, she's gonna dish it right back out. She can punish your opponent for killing her in combat. That's pretty sweet. 4 loyalty, plus 1, exile the top card of your library you can play it this turn, which is a leap and bound improvement over the last one, in that you can play the lands that you hit off of it. Instead of templating it so that when you hit lands, your opponent just takes 2, you can just play the land and then continue on with whatever else you were going to do. You know, if you needed a land drop desperately and you draw for turn and then you just really want to see what you get off of Chandra, it doesn't hurt you. And then minus 7, exile the top 7 cards of your library, you may play them this turn. So you get a much more powerful version of the first ability instead of doing a bunch of other weird stuff and probably warping the format around you, which is a better design to me, at least. And my cousin Cody loves him some Jaya Venerated Fire Mage just because he's always been a big Jaya Ballard fan. loved Jaya Ballard ever since she first got mentioned in story talks. So, you know, he's all the way in on that, even if she's not very powerful. You know, we have Awakening of Vidugazi. Casual 5-mana, instant 9/9. To say nothing of what happens when you use it with Ink Moth Nexus, which becomes a 10/10 flying infect and kills someone in Commander. Anyway, it's obviously too slow for Modern, but somebody's going to do it. I know they will. Silent Submarine, blue-blue, 2/3, when it deals combat damage to a player or planeswalker, draw a card, which takes away the drawback of something like a Curious Obsession kind of thing, where if you're attacking a planeswalker with it, you're not getting full value. It's really interesting that they made this vehicle kind of make up for that, and it's crew 2, so a car it can swing in when you really want to retain your wizard for, you know, playing mono-blue. It's pretty good at 2 mana. The fact that it doesn't send your Merfolk Trickster into combat, meaning it doesn't die, meaning you can still leave up Wizard's Retort while threatening to draw extra cards like you would if you had an Obsession on the table. It's pretty sweet. And then the card that I will probably try way too hard to make work, Enter the God Eternals. In the words of Shaheen Serrani, if you think this is what I want to be doing in my blue-black control deck, you are absolutely right. 2 blue-blue-black, sorcery, Enter the God Eternals deals 4 damage to target creature, and you gain life equal to the damage dealt this way. Target player puts the top 4 cards of their library into their graveyard. Amass 4. So, you get a 4/4 if you don't have an army with any power on it at all. Like, if you don't have you don't already have a pre-existing army, you just get a 4/4. You kill a 4/4 or an X/4. Gain 4. And mill 4. Now, the mill 4 can be a benefit. Usually going to be a... You know, the fact that you get to choose who mills 4 is relevant, because you don't have to target them. If you've got a graveyard thing you want to do yourself, you can take advantage of it. Super powerful. Exactly what I want to be doing in my control decks at 5 mana. If it's remotely viable. But the fact that it is a 4/4 creature, a removal spell, a life gain... Like... It's Lightning Helix plus a 4/4, plus a little bit of disruption if they're playing the other God Eternals. Like, you can kill it, and then... No, it'll tuck after, anyway. You know, you could do something like Teferi, tuck your creature, and then enter the God Eternals to kill something else. And that would mill the thing you tucked. That's powerful. And it just, like, it's so much text on one card, I can't help but want to play it. Tameo Collector of Tales. 2 green-blue, 5 loyalty. Spells and abilities your opponents control can't cause you to discard cards or sacrifice permanents. Hello, Commander. We've needed this effect for a while on a card that's harder to interact with than an enchantment. And then Tameo rewards the Miracles styles of decks in Commander. Choose a non-land card name, reveal the top 4 cards of your library, put all cards with the chosen name from among them into your hand, and the rest into your graveyard. And she doesn't stop there. She can still give you value off the ones you dumped with -3, return target card from your graveyard to your hand. So she's, if you play her, +1, and then -3/-3, you are getting a 3-for-1. As long as you can play around with the top of your library at all. In a format where Sensei's Divining Top is legal. I mean, these decks kind of build themselves sometimes, right? But all the way around, I love the fact that they've brought so many planeswalkers back, so many just unique, powerful effects. The flavor of the mechanics are beautiful. The way they've been spoiling the cards is great. Like, everything about this set that I've seen so far, I've liked. And I can't really say that about any set that I've experienced basically ever. So with that, we're going to end on a high note. And if you want to reach out to the show, you can do so on Twitter. I'm at HomewardPathMTG. You can reach me on Facebook. My name is Adam Spain. You can join the Facebook group. We are the Homeward Pathfinders. It's open invite. Just request to join. I don't know. I can't speak for how the other two admins do their jobs, but when I see a request, I will give a quick look through of the profile, make sure. You know, I want to be sure. I want to be careful. And then, last but not least, you can tweet the show and become a part of the show every week with hashtag MTG Dad Jokes. So, been at this a while, and I kind of got that old man mentality. And I love a good creative pun. And I love that there's so many in the community that are willing to help me do this. So, to start with, let's see, did I do that one last week? We're just going to go ahead and use it. So it's the tweet is by the girl with the lotus tattoo. It says, Soren and Nahiri face off. Nahiri, hey, what's your family's favorite ice cream? Rocky end of the road? Soren, I'm going to stab you now. Nahiri, you always were a stone cold killer. Soren, I dig it. I love it. I really hope the actual showdown goes something like that in the book. Can't wait to get the book, by the way. It's going to be so good. It's going to be so good. Second on the list, we have Mark Rosewater, Tales from the Pit, number 2017. Says, Whatley learned the hard way that there just isn't all that big an audience for dinosaur poetry. But I rhymed stegosaur with dino rapport. Come on, guys. What do you want from me? No. next up, we have the Asian Avenger, who, in reference to Ilharg the Razbor, which is the missing link in the god cycle, because we are not going to get Hazoret as a god eternal. Instead, we get the boar god of Ravnica. 6/6 trample, when it attacks, you can put a creature from your hand into the battlefield tapped and attacking. Return that creature to your hand at the beginning of the next end step. When it dies or is put into exile from the battlefield, put it into its owner's library third from the top. So, powerful. A lot of people are trying to figure out ways to kill people with this, including just curving it into Ronus, where it attacks, Ronus is plopped into play, tapped and attacking, and doubles Ilharg's power. So you just brain him for 17, and Ilharg's 12 is trample. And then Ronus bounces back to your hand to do it again next turn. Like, that's disgusting. And Asian Avenger says, this card seems boring. B-O-A-R, boring. I appreciate it. I really do. That one, it takes some guts to put that on the internet. Somebody is going to light you on fire for that. Somebody's going to be angry. That's going to make someone angry, so I appreciate the commitment. And then last but not least, we have Tales from the Pit number 2018 from Mark Rosewater. Coming to Lifetime this summer, Snakes on a Brain, the Vraska story. Why can I see that being made? Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. I really appreciate it. I hope you like the new audio. I tested it out when it got in this morning, did a couple of different little test bits. It does interface much more favorably with my computer, which I like. And you know, I'm keeping the recon as a backup just in case this one poops out on me really quick or something, but whatever the case may be. Thanks everybody for listening. I appreciate you making it possible for me to update the equipment that I'm using. And let me know what you're interested in going forward. I cannot express just how much I love doing this show. And I couldn't do it without somebody listening and telling me what they liked and didn't like. So I really, really do appreciate it. And especially after a week like we've had, it's everything I needed to just kind of decompress for half an hour and get all this out. But I think my clothes are about dry. So with all of that, we're going to sign off until the next trip.